How do you do, ladies and gentlemen? This is the moment I was looking forward to more than any other since I took over this show a couple of months ago, because I find that Daniel Pipes is a guy that I've been reading for many months, for years, in the New York Post and in other papers, and I know that any time you mention his name, people think of him as the final authority on all Middle Eastern affairs, and especially on the whole issue of the Muslims, what they represent compared to what they pretend to be, how much is of the Muslim story is a matter of danger, and how much is a matter of legitimacy, where they really stand on what issues compared to what we think. Because there's so much confusion all over America about what we should think of the Muslims. Who's legitimate among them, and how much of a threat are they really? Are we exaggerating the threat? What is the issue from every point of view? And I purposely made sure we have enough time to explore the issue in a little more depth today. And we had an imam last week who gave us the side of the story from the point of view of the Muslims. And he sounded like a very moderate man who was trying to explain to me that all these accusations are not true. But to what extent some of these accusations are true or not, I think are best known by a man like Daniel Pipes. So he wrote so many books on the subject. So I'd like to hear what he has to say. Hello, Daniel Pipes.
Hello, Jackie Mason.
It's sort of a long introduction, but your history of scholarship on this issue is so extensive that I don't think I even came anywhere close to it with my explanation of who you are. But the main thing I want to ask you is this. Let's start off this question. He was justifying everything that the Muslims basically are doing and every portrayal that we have about them in terms of any negative attitude. He explained to me why it's so wrong. Like one of the things he said when I said the Quran, why is it saying the Quran that you should scar and maim and destroy the infidel and everybody who's heretic or anybody represents another religion somehow doesn't deserve the right to even live on this earth, and he should be destroyed? And he said it's totally misinterpreted. Would you say that it is misinterpreted? What is the story of the Quran?
Well, what the imam was doing last week was saying, in effect, there are a lot of pretty hair-raising passages in the Bible, too.
Right.
But the big difference is that those hair-raising passages in the Bible are defunct. Nobody implements them. They're not operational. Whereas those in the Quran, to a large extent, are. And specifically, beheading is. It's happening all the time. So what needs to happen is for Muslims to say, well, there are these verses in the Quran, but they're no longer operative. They're no longer something that we follow. That moment hasn't yet come, and it's unfortunately a significant way off.
But besides which, whatever says in the Bible about committing any kind of violence doesn't anywhere approach in anywhere near the kind of suggestion that you see in the Quran. There's no place in the Bible that says kill and destroy the infidel or whoever doesn't believe in your religion.
No, but it doesn't quite say that in the Quran either. But I'll agree with you, the Quran is more political, more military than the Bible, but the Bible does have its elements. The key point is not so much to compare them, but to say time for Muslims to go beyond the literal interpretation of these Quranic passages. Let me give an example. In Christianity, in Judaism, and in Islam, one has various forms of slavery. In the course of centuries past, Jews and Christians have come to the conclusion that slavery is an abomination. They didn't come to this conclusion lightly. I mean, think of the Civil War in this country. It wasn't an easy conclusion. But Muslims have not yet come to that conclusion. There is slavery in many countries, Saudi Arabia, Sudan, Mauritania, Niger, Pakistan, and even, I documented a few weeks ago, in the United States. Saudis bring slaves to the United States.
I want to ask you a question. When I ask a Muslim why this is still taking place in so many of Muslim countries, slavery, the way the women are totally mistreated, the way they have no rights at all as a human being, they can't drive, they could be, if they commit adultery, they could be stoned, the husband is free to kill them in some countries, if they have any premarital relationship, they are destroyed as a human being, the family themselves would kill them or destroy them. When I tell them all these things happen under the guise of the Muslim religion or in Muslim countries, they all say the same thing to me, that this is cultural. This has nothing to do with the religion itself. Now, what would you say about that?
Well, I'd say that it is an apology. Yes, it lies in the religion and comes out of the religion. And indeed, one of the shocking things is to find the same kind of action and behavior now in the United States. I mentioned slavery. We have example after example of Saudis treating their servants like slaves, not allowing them out of the house. There was just an appalling example in Detroit of an older brother beating up his younger sister, breaking her back, and the parents okay with it because she had maybe been seeing a non-Muslim boy. This is, yeah, it's cultural, but it comes out of provisions in the Quran. It needs to be addressed face on. And this is a profound religious and cultural transformation that has really yet to begin in the Muslim world, including the Muslim world in the United States, the Muslims in the United States.
In other words, what you're saying is that the country, what if I identify all the Muslim countries where this doesn't happen? And what if these people say to me, who are innocent of this kind of behavior, when they say to me, the Quran, in no place in the Quran do they suggest or believe or teach in any way to treat women this way. Women are treated this way as an offshoot of a culture that they created that is a direct violation of the Muslim treatise,
well,
of the Muslim of the Muslim faith.
At that point,
what's that?
Say that it becomes a little bit abstract to say. I mean, take the issue of women and the covering of women.
Right.
It does not actually say in the Quran that a woman's face must be covered, but it is a natural interpretation from the Quran about the modesty of women to say, well, if women are going to be modest, then they really have to be covered from head to toe. And that is the case, for example, in Afghanistan. Now, it did not literally in the Quran say that a woman must have a burqa on her and her face not be seen, but it is something that comes out of the Quran, and it needs to be, you know, it needs to be faced, it needs to be confronted, it needs to be changed. That, again, hasn't really even begun. Or put it even more pessimistically, there was movement a century ago. Muslims were leaving this. Women were coming out from under the veil and the headscarf and the burqa. And now what one's seen in the last generation is a return towards it. So we're actually going backwards.
So what's your opinion? What you're trying to say is that you think in the long run the Muslims are becoming more restrictive toward women and they're losing their democratic rights more and more, and it's becoming more autocratic and more violent towards women or towards infidels.
And, yes.
In other words, the Muslim religion towards the rest of the world and towards its own women is becoming worse and worse. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I started studying this subject in 1969. At that time, the radical Islamic trend, which is now so powerful and, you know, and the reason why we're talking about it today, was negligible. And at that time still, after about a century and a half, there was a movement towards westernization, eradicating slavery. 1962, for example, the Saudi Arabian government got rid of slavery. Movement towards giving women more rights and the like. That has, in the last 36 years, been reversed, and reversed very dramatically. And now what one finds is the dominant theme in the Muslim world is a return to a more stringent, harsher version of Islam, less Western version.
Uh-huh. I'm sorry to have to interrupt you. I got your point that we have more points to make and much more information to get out. We have to have a break now. I'm sorry. We'll be back in a moment. How do you do, ladies and gentlemen? After the education we got from the Imam about his side of the story with reference to the Muslims and why he feels they're such a totally peaceful, loving, kind religion, and even though it seems to contradict what so much of us learn from the stories we hear in the Quran and in the education in the schools, I'd like to ask Daniel Pipes, who's the director of Middle East Forum and a very well-known writer who's written many books and columns on the subject. He's considered the final authority on the whole story of the Middle East. I'd like to ask him, what's your honest opinion? You have a right to your opinion. I had the highest respect for the Imam. Now I want to hear what you think of why all this this hate that comes across in the texts of all the schools, to hate Jews, to hate Christians, and all this, the beheadings, killings, murder, destruction of everybody from any other religion. What is the story in your opinion?
And you have the highest respect for my opinion too?
Right.
Okay. The reason that the schools, mosques, and other institutions are dominated by this hate-filled discourse is that the institutions of American Islam are in turn dominated by radical Islam. There are hardly any, 10, 20, 30% maybe, that are in the hands of moderates. The Saudis put a lot of money in starting in the 60s. It just so happens that immigrants and converts who get highly involved in institutional Muslim life generally have a radical outlook, so they predominate. It doesn't have to be that way, but it certainly is that way. As recently as today, I wrote a column called A Madrasa in Bridgeview, Illinois, telling about the really extraordinarily radical information that a Time magazine report told us about a suburb of Chicago.
In other words, all this education in the schools that are full of hate, what you say represents the basic thinking of Muslims in general?
No, I'm saying it represents a radical strain, the Islamist strain.
Yeah, but what percentage of the Muslim people themselves do you feel behave this way or are indoctrinated to behave this way?
I would say that about 10 to 15% of Muslims want to live under the Islamic law, want to live this way. But as with communists or fascists, it only takes a small number to dominate. Because of their energy,
I see. But you feel they're only 10-15% of the real population.
So I think it is a quite small minority. But as in the case of
but they have violent power and a tremendous influence, and they can accomplish phenomenal things because they're independent of anybody else, and they don't care about the Muslim thinking in general. Hello, hello. I want to get back to Daniel Pipes because this is a very important question. He just told us something that's fascinating. You just said to us that things are going to get worse and discrimination against women and the hold on all these anti-democratic practices are going to get even worse in all the Islamic countries. Now, if that's the case, I'd like to ask you this question. Right now in Iran, a hardliner was elected in Iran to become the new boss of the country. Now, what does this represent in terms of how he will rule Iran? Will things get much worse in Iran, and will they become even more of a threat to America than they are now in terms of the hydrogen bomb and everything they're developing?
Well, a couple of points. I didn't say they're going to get worse. I said they have been getting worse. And I think part of the goal of our war against radical Islam must be to have in mind a goal of improving it. But so far, you know, in the last 20 years, things have gotten much worse. As for Iran, the election was for a pretty nominal post. You may remember 8 years ago, a man by the name of Khatami took over, and there was great hope that he, as president, could make a lot of improvements. Mm. In fact, he could do almost nothing, because the president is a very powerless
thing. Oh, he's a powerless position, and the way they describe it in the New York Times today, they make it sound like he's going to be the new ruler of the country.
Well,
they give you a completely lopsided view of this whole situation.
What do you expect if you read the New York Times?
I really expect them to be a lot of crap, but I didn't think it was that bad that they misrepresent the whole story. Let me ask you a question from Philadelphia here. The man has a very interesting question. I want to see if we could deal with this question first before we go any further. What's on your mind, my friend, from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania? Hello, Jeff? Jeff from Philadelphia. Hello?
Hello?
Yes, sir. What's your question?
Oh, my question? Well, I saw an episode of you about maybe a couple of weeks ago.
Yes.
You were saying how, essentially we have no business to be over there, and I just feel that that's really not the way to support our troops, especially in a time of crisis like this.
I'm sorry to tell you that's not what I said. If I said that, that's not what I meant. You got the wrong impression. That's not at all what we were talking about. This call will serve no purpose. Let me ask you another question. Why is it when I meet Muslims in the streets of New York or any place else, they sound like they're full of love and compassion, and they don't look like any kind of a threat to other people? They never commit any crimes, and we're always told how they're raised in their schools to hate everybody from every opposing religion. Now, why do they have so much love when you meet them?
Well, the problem is with a minority of Muslims. My estimate is that some 10-15% of Muslims like radical Islam, agree with radical Islam, want to promote radical Islam. That is not a large percentage of the Muslim population.
Uh-huh.
But if they're, say, a billion Muslims, that means 100 to 150 million Muslims. So it is a very substantial body of people. Now, not all of those people are terrorists by any means, but they have...
They are sympathetic to that direction.
They have a great desire to live along the lines of Islamic law, and that has also some implications, including a desire to destroy Israel, a desire to take over the United States.
I understand. I understand exactly your point. I'm sorry to have to interrupt you. Unfortunately, the time is up. Tom Cruise is on next week with his new girlfriend.